Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Monday, July 7, 2014. After 2 weeks, I've been off the grid and out of touch, but I'm back in the saddle again.
I'm back in the saddle again, out where a friend is a friend, where the longhorn cattle feed on the lowly Jimson wheat. Back in the saddle again.
I had a wonderful break. I spent 2 weeks away from the microphone and mostly off the grid, and my friends Alberto and Heloisa from Brazil came to visit. We rented an RV and explored 1,200 miles of the back roads of Northern California. We did the coast along Sonoma and Mendocino, then to Mount Shasta, a spectacular place if you've never been there. Saw an incredible sky show from 7,000 feet up on Mount Shasta. Also went to a great place called Burney Falls, dropped in on Lake Tahoe, and lots of points in between. So I'm back and catching up on developments in the news. I was largely unplugged, but, you know, I can't resist. I see a newspaper here. I look at a little headline on my phone, read a few stories on Facebook. And the most appalling, of course, was the Supreme Court decision in the Hobby Lobby case. We'll get to that. I do like to occasionally acknowledge when the Supreme Court makes a decision that I approve of. And a 9-0 ruling written by Chief Justice Roberts in very strong language affirmed our Fourth Amendment rights that a police officer cannot look at our telephone, cannot search the contents of a phone in the course of an arrest without a court order. That's right, they need a warrant based on probable cause. Now, this is a very important affirmation of our Fourth Amendment rights. It's something that I've been ranting about for several years, because here in California, we have a great state senator from San Francisco, Mark Leno, who has two or three times passed legislation that was vetoed by the allegedly liberal governor here, Jerry Brown. And those laws would have required, at the state level, a warrant before they can search my phone. And so Jerry Brown dragged his feet. I am actually a little surprised that the Roberts Court has really upstaged him. And now the state law would be irrelevant because, of course, the federal law takes precedence. So on that score, the Supreme Court did the right thing. Then there is this botched case, this corporate Catholic alliance in the Hobby Lobby case. And there is no rational explanation. Justice Alito, who wrote the opinion, claims it was very narrow. But it was narrow enough to drive several Mack trucks through. And by granting a right to religious freedom and religious liberty to a corporation, even one that is closely held mostly by family members, is a preposterous precedent to set, and one that we will have to live with for many years to come. As the court will be bombarded with different religious people and groups and advocates who say, well, we need an exception. We want to be able to discriminate against gays. We want to be able to discriminate against people who don't currently believe our faith. And so by empowering the owners of Hobby Lobby and the Mennonite company that was a co-plaintiff in the case to pick and choose what kind of birth control they will allow their employees' insurance to cover is just horrendous. And the idea that the religious rights of a corporation, which of course I think don't exist, would be given greater weight than the right of an individual to choose what kind of medical coverage they get, including contraception. And I have no idea where the court can find that because an employer pays all or part of the health insurance coverage for the employee, that they have the right to dictate what is in that coverage. And if you're listening to this podcast, you probably don't need any more persuasion on this issue. But I was just stunned when I first heard about it last week. And I have to say, my friends from Brazil were so puzzled. I tried to explain it to them, and it really just doesn't make sense to them. And they come from a culture that is really much more progressive, much more open than our Christianist fundamentalist culture here is in the United States today. Frankly, I find it embarrassing. For the past week, I've been waiting for Glenn Greenwald to drop the dime that he's been promising. And he has acknowledged on Twitter that his release of what he called his final blockbuster article from the Ed Snowden cache of NSA documents has been held up because of complaints by unnamed U.S. government officials. And I just checked over at his website, The Intercept, before I started talking here today, and there is no update since June 18. And Greenwald had said his final piece. Now, first of all, to consider that even if we use the lowest estimates of the number of files that Ed Snowden handed off to Glenn Greenwald, Laura Poitras, and Bart Gellman at The Washington Post, is at least in the range of tens of thousands. The government at one point was saying it was in the millions. It's really hard to believe that we are at the end of the line of the Snowden cache. But that's what Greenwald says. Clearly, he's not planning to publish everything in a WikiLeaks style. And while that is not the ultimate standard for me, I have a hard time believing that, for example, one of the original disclosures a year ago was about the PRISM program. And they released a series of slides from a PowerPoint presentation about PRISM. By my count, we have only seen about 10 or 12 of what we were told was a 45-slide presentation. That's just one glaring example of the way the media has worked as a gatekeeper, a filter. And while I can believe that there are some rational arguments not to disclose certain things, it really does seem that Greenwald is erring on the side of the government. And so it's a week since he promised that information would land on June 30th at midnight. And meanwhile, the Washington Post has gone forward, not with the same article. Now, one of the reasons that I've been hoping for this piece from Greenwald is that my hope is that it will confirm the whistleblowing of Russell Tice on this podcast and the podcast I've done with Sibel Edmonds at BoilingFrogsPost.com, where Russell Tice told us that he was aware he had information, evidence about the wiretapping of top government officials. And that's what I'm hoping Greenwald's blockbuster is or will be able to confirm. But since it hasn't been published, we can only speculate at this point. Now to the piece by Bart Gellman that was published over the weekend in the Washington Post, where he reveals that in a review of over 150,000 accounts that were intercepted by the NSA, that 9 out of 10 of those account holders found in a large cache of intercepted conversations were not the intended surveillance targets. So what this means is that in order to target a single individual, the NSA is willing to include in that dragnet 9 innocent individuals, and not only scoop up and review their information, but store it indefinitely. And this is another outrage that should fuel demands from the public and our elected officials for reform. And I fear that it will lead to another yawn by most Americans and a hope by our leaders that they can just ignore this and it'll go away. But as Gellman reports, the files highlight a policy dilemma that's been aired only abstractly in public. There are discoveries of considerable intelligence value in the intercepted messages and collateral harm to privacy on a scale that the Obama administration has not been willing to address. Now, even in this case, the Post freely acknowledges that it is censoring, it is filtering, it is withholding information even as it reveals these important factors. So, the Post will not describe in detail among the most valuable contents to avoid interfering with ongoing operations. They tease us about a secret overseas nuclear project, double dealing by an ostensible ally. Well, you give me that line, I'd say Pakistan. A military calamity that befell an unfriendly power. Not sure what that means. And the identities of aggressive intruders into U.S. computer networks. So, the Post was willing to publish one example of where this massive collection, where 9 out of 10 people surveilled are innocent. They said that months of tracking communications across more than 50 alias accounts led directly to the 2011 capture in Abbottabad of Muhammad Tahir Shahzad, the Pakistan-based bomb builder, and Umar Patek, a suspect in the 2002 terrorist bombing on the Indonesian island of Bali. But at the request of CIA officials, the Post is withholding other examples that officials said would compromise ongoing operations. So the Post reviewed about 160,000 email and instant message accounts. And they say these files offer an unprecedented vantage point on the changes from Section 702 of the FISA amendments. Now remember, this was the bill that Obama opposed early in 2008 as a presidential candidate, and once he sewed up the nomination, he voted for it in August, shortly before he was nominated at the convention in Denver. And so Section 702 is widely used and abused by the intelligence communities to gather information well beyond what the FISA court has authorized, what the law permits. Here's an example. One analyst, a military analyst, a female here, said one target, 38 others on there. This was a chat room where a target entered. Nevertheless, the NSA collected information on all 38 people in that chat room. And so what the Post concludes is that the government, in its limited disclosures to the American public, even still, has grossly underestimated the number of people who were targets of last year's collection under FISA Section 702. The government admitted to 89,000, and the Post, doing the simple math of 9 to 1, says, well, that means about 900,000, if we're going to be honest about it. Now, Ed Snowden offered comments to Bart Gellman at the Washington Post. He said that these primary documents offer the only path to a concrete debate about the cost and benefits of Section 702 surveillance. He did not favor public release of the full archive, he said, but he didn't think a reporter could understand the programs without being able to review some of that surveillance, both justified and unjustified. And here's a quote from Snowden. Even if one could conceivably justify the initial inadvertent interception of baby pictures and love letters of innocent bystanders, their continued storage in government databases is both troubling and dangerous. Who knows how that information will be used in the future? And the Post also notes that, once again, Keith Alexander, the former boss at the NSA, has been contradicted because he said that Ed Snowden didn't get any of this kind of information. Oops. I guess you got skunked again there, General Alexander. So, as we review this situation, we get pushback from the White House. The Obama administration is playing down, saying, don't worry. The NSA filters out all this information related to U.S. persons. Well, I don't find that believable. I must exercise my right to call bullshit when I see bullshit. And speaking of bullshit, there was a report last week from the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board. Now, to its credit, this panel did say that the metadata phone collection, which, by the way, was just approved for the fifth time since Ed Snowden revealed all this over a year ago, that the metadata program is a violation of law and doesn't have much practical value. But this same group said that the 702 collection has enabled the government to acquire a greater range of foreign intelligence than it otherwise would have been able to obtain, and to do so quickly and effectively, and that it has proven valuable in the government's efforts to combat terrorism as well as other areas of foreign intelligence. Well, I don't really think that's the purview of this board. The issue to me is whether it complies with the Fourth Amendment to our Constitution. That's what this panel should be looking at. And the rationalization that it's okay to violate the Fourth Amendment if we catch a terrorist? Well, forgive me. Once more, I must call bullshit. Meanwhile, in the Middle East, things are really, really very sensitive, and we have waves of retaliation and retribution underway. As you know, three young Israelis were missing and then found dead in a shallow grave. They had been living in one of the illegal Jewish-Israeli settlements. And so far, we don't really know who's responsible for their abduction and death. Benjamin Netanyahu, the leader of Israel, flatly states that he knows it's Hamas. And yet he has offered not a shred of proof. And at the funeral of these three young people, Netanyahu essentially called for revenge. And some Israelis went out and grabbed a Palestinian boy. I think he was 16. They tortured him. They set him on fire. The autopsy shows that he was still alive while his body was being burned. And while Netanyahu called the family and has offered a hypocritical apology, it's very clear that he set in motion this kind of retaliation, revenge killing, and he wants to have it both ways. And I have a dispatch here from Susan Abulawa, who writes from, I believe, the West Bank, and notes that so far, over 570 Palestinians have been kidnapped and imprisoned over the three missing Israelis, one of whom had dual American citizenship. At least 10 Palestinians have been killed. I can update that to 16 now, including at least three children, a pregnant woman and a mentally ill man. Hundreds have been injured, thousands terrorized, universities and social welfare organizations ransacked, shut down, computers and equipment destroyed or stolen. And that's before we get to the airstrikes that Israel has launched over the past days and almost a week now. And this has produced a vow of further revenge from Hamas. And it's hard to imagine just how this cycle of violence will be tamped down. One of the conservative types, a Zionist, who unbelievably was assigned by President Obama to represent the United States in the Israel-Palestine peace talks that have failed, Martin Indyk, an old hand who served twice as ambassador to Israel, was one of Bill Clinton's peace negotiators. A guy whose tilt toward Israel is just so well identified that he had no role, no possible credible role, in brokering a deal between the Israelis and Palestinians. And I can't put my finger on it, but there was a powerful commentary by one of the lead writers at the Israeli newspaper Haaretz over the past few days, where this Israeli questioned whether his country is serious at all about peace. And I have to say that I can only underscore and amplify his question, Because I think the answer is pretty clear, and the answer is no. Meanwhile, just a few clicks away in Iraq, the civil war continues. The Maliki government that we put in power, the Shiite government in Baghdad, is resisting all calls for any kind of reconciliation with the Kurds and the Sunnis, saying first we need to militarily defeat the Sunni uprising, the so-called ISIS group. And what this means is that now we have 800 American troops back in Iraq. And all we really can do is watch this thing break up. The partitioning of Iraq is very clear to me. That will occur, partly driven by the Kurdish officials in response to the failure of the Baghdad government to form a new government following the parliamentary elections. And the Kurds feel that their best future is an independent Kurdistan, made up of Turkey, Iraq, and Syria, or at least territory from those three countries. And when you combine this with the video that was released over the weekend, giving us a first glimpse of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, who now claims imam status and says he is developing a caliphate based on the notion of the Ottoman Empire and its predecessors. And it's really interesting because I read six or seven different accounts of this video, and in most of them, it referred to him as the purported leader of ISIS or ISIL. Only the New York Times flatly says this is the real guy, and it's not purported or alleged. And so he is putting out a call for jihad to Muslims worldwide. And I think it will resonate with many of them as the U.S. supports the crackdown on Muslims in Egypt and is seen as hardly a neutral party in the struggle between Sunni and Shia in Iraq and elsewhere. So that situation continues to fester, and it's hard once again to see how things start to calm down. Meanwhile, back here in the United States, it was appalling to see Americans in Southern California, the town of Murrieta in Riverside County, not far from the Mexican border. They came out in droves to offer hateful comments and screams and shouts to busloads of these children who have been attempting to cross the southern border. And I recognize this as a real serious problem, not just for the Obama administration, but for our country. And it is fair when Obama and his friends blame the Republicans for a failure to move forward on any meaningful immigration reform, that it is a driver of this problem. But these kids have been approaching the border since January or February. I don't know why it took so long for the media to start to report this. And the Obama administration, you know, we're now sending airplane loads of these children from point A to point B in the United States. Our laws require, if they are not from Mexico, that they have to be processed in this country before they can be deported. And so I can't in any way align with the hateful Minutemen and the anti-immigration extremists. But that doesn't mean that I can't acknowledge that the Obama administration has screwed this up really badly and given the opponents of immigration reform more ammunition to say, look, they can't control the border. How can we possibly move forward on policy changes? Now, not all the opposition is rational, but when you provide this kind of a situation, it makes them look more rational. And I have to say that Obama has really, really screwed up on this one. In Asia, citizens of Hong Kong have been turning out in the hundreds of thousands, demanding more of a democratic role in picking the leaders of this. Hong Kong is a possession of China, but it's given special latitude from the Beijing government. And Beijing has been trying to reel in some of the freedom of the people of Hong Kong. And we saw that 800,000 people in Hong Kong participated in a non-binding informal vote, demanding that they be given a voice in the selection of the top official who runs Hong Kong. So I find that encouraging. I always like to see people standing up for their rights. This is discouraging from Asia. The conservative government in Japan of Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has redefined its constitution and the role of the military in Japan. Now, you know, the United States wrote the constitution for Japan during the post-war period back in 1947 and defined that the Japanese military could only be in self-defense. Because of recent conflicts with China and the U.S. tilt toward Asia, the Obama administration has been encouraging the Abe government to rewrite the rules on the role of the Japanese military. And I think this is a big mistake, because Japan had carved out a role, not like Switzerland, not totally pacifist, but a role where it no longer showed any evidence of military aggression or any kind of desire to expand its empire. And I think that this move will make Japan more vulnerable to a military attack in the future, not less. Finally today, I want to recommend an op-ed. I'll see if I can find a link for it. It's in Sunday's New York Times, July 6, written by Jacob Heilbrun, the editor of the National Interest. And he wrote a book called They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons. And in a piece that is not highly charged, but is very persuasive and has a lot of strong argument, he points out that the neocons who brought us George W. Bush, the Project for a New American Century, the invasion of Iraq, and many other blunders, are now putting their bets on Hillary Rodham Clinton. That's right. The neocons believe that a Rand Paul candidate from the Republican Party would not properly represent their expansive vision and interests. But Hillary? Oh! She is their champion. The article cites Robert Kagan in a piece he recently wrote for the New Republic. It's described as a neocon manifesto. And he praised Hillary Clinton in that piece. So recently has Max Boot, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, a notable neocon thinker. And they're both kind of hedging their bets. And this article by Heilbrun points out these neocons have a point. Mrs. Clinton voted for the Iraq War, supported sending arms to Syrian rebels, likened Russia's President Putin to Adolf Hitler, wholeheartedly backs Israel, and stresses the importance of promoting democracy. It's easy to imagine, the article says, Mrs. Clinton making room for the neocons in her administration. No one could charge her with being weak on national security with the likes of Robert Kagan on board. And I will add to that the kinds of validation that have been offered by Robert Gates, who was the Republican. He was the last Secretary of Defense for Bush and was held over by Obama. And in his memoir called Duty, Bob Gates kisses up to Hillary Rodham Clinton on almost every chance he gets. Often says that the two of them were the only adults in the room. And I find it really frightening when you get an endorsement like that from Bob Gates, and when the neocons decide that a Democratic woman is the one who will best represent their interests from 2016 forward? I hope it gives pause to some of you folks who claim you're ready for Hillary. Because, as we pointed out recently in the piece at thenation.com, published by Robert Dreyfus and his wife Barbara, there is ample evidence of the real hawkish leanings of Hillary Clinton. They should not be ignored by people who want the symbol of the first woman president. Because regardless of her sex, Hillary Clinton is not a friend to the interests of liberals, progressives, and those who really support peace and justice around the world. Hey, thanks for listening today. It's great to be back. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.